Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the evil clone of Duncan Nickel, here to take his place.
Duncan, I'm glad we got back to The Last Command after a little break to read Children of Anguish and Anarchy, but we are here now to conclude Timothy Zorn's trilogy.
We are indeed. If this is your first time joining us, now more than ever, please go back and listen to the episodes in the previous two books in the Thrawn trilogy, Heir to the Empire and Dark Force Rising. This is our third trilogy we've ever finished, Geordie.
That's right, and we did them two in a row.
I'll be asking you how it ranks. I want to know, where does this fall between Legacy of Arisha and His Dark Materials?
I mean, that's really an unfair comparison, to be honest. Like, if you listen to our previous episode, you'll know that Children of Anguish and Anarchy ended with a bit of a whimper, and His Dark Materials is one of the best fantasy series of all time. So, it's in the middle, but that means nothing.
That's very fair. Geordie, before we jump into this, have you read, watched, experienced anything else in the interim?
Not really, no. I've been saving my reading. I've been waiting for... I'm about to go on holiday.
Oh, have fun.
So we're recording this literally the day before I depart, and I have to... I'm going to edit it as fast as I can so I can catch my plane and still get an episode out. But I'm going to be hiking in Sweden. Last year I went to Scotland and I read... Oh, what was I reading for the podcast last year? It was Warbreaker. So last year I read Warbreaker on the trek, and this time I will be reading the book I pick at the end of this episode.
Can't wait to find out what that is, mate.
But yes, no reading on my behalf. So over to you, Duncan.
Well, as you know from our previous episode, I mentioned to you that I've been reading Nemesis Games, the fifth book in the Expanse series, and I have finally finished it, Geordie. And well, I have thoughts, and I don't want to spend too much on those thoughts, but I actually feel a little bit mixed on this one. I love
that's interesting.
I've loved every book I've read in The Expanse, but I've quickly discovered that I think I have quite a different taste on it than I think you do. Because I know you loved Abaddon's Gate, the third book. It's like one of your faves.
Yeah, great book. It's one of my faves.
It sits a little lower for me, and I think you like Nemesis Games, and this sat a little lower for me.
I think Nemesis Games is the best one.
I didn't feel the same. I don't know. I feel like I want to dig into this so much. But for me, okay, here are the key points of why I really enjoyed Nemesis Games. I love all the Expanse books that I've read. This is a great book. There are scenes in this. There are world events that push the setting forward in ways that are interesting and really shake up the status quo. There's some interesting... It's kind of this book, with five books into the series, you get so much more character development for like the... side character ensemble cast. You really go into their backstories about time. That was amazing. I think where this book kind of fell short a little bit for me is that The Expanse is this sci-fi series that kind of split between these two major world elements. Okay, you've got this alien technology, and you've got what's out there, what's beyond, what's in The Expanse, what happened to this grand alien empire that fell. But then the real focus is the humanity. Humans are humans, and we're always a bit shit to each other. And Nemesis Games, more so than I think any of the books in the series thus far, really zeroes in on that second part of it. This is about humanity. This is about our response to opportunity and how we treat each other and our fears of progress.
Yeah. And everything that happens in the book has nothing really to do with the alien technology existing. It's about humanity's reaction to the fact that it exists and what it means about how we have to treat each other.
And for me, that's just, like, I love it. I just don't love it as much or as I love them in combination. And I think the other element, because I brought this up when I first talked about The Expanse, I love all The Expanse books. So I feel like they're all both building on this series, but, like, self-contained. I get a satisfying ending. And Nemesis Games is the first one that kind of leaves it fairly open. It starts that's with right. our characters getting split up. It ends with them coming back together. But it kind of ends on a round table scene of them going, right, now we're back together. Now the Avengers have reassembled. Let's take on the villain. And then roll credits.
That's true. That thing is different. And I do remember I felt a little bit jarred at the end as well. Like, oh, it's over? I think that's just like with Abaddon's Gate. I was so caught up in reading the book. I can't remember if I've told this on the podcast before, if I've just said it In fact, no, I had. I said a quote recently about how in Abaddon's Gate, I thought the book was already over a third of the way in because of how exciting one scene was. I thought it had to be the climax of the book. With Nemesis Games, I was so amped up and not paying attention to the length that I really thought we were halfway through. Because I was like, yes, 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 and now we're gonna get at the bad guys, right? We've survived, we've got back together, and now we're gonna take it to them. Oh, wait, the book's over. It completely snuck up on me.
And I'm sure that's like an issue that would be instantly corrected when I read the next book. Because obviously now the next book is perfectly set up, and I'm so excited to dive into it. But yeah, that I think that's why, as like a standalone issue in the Expanse series, it's a little lower. But the prison break scene was ace, mate. Oh. Wow, chef's kiss. Loved it.
Duncan, have you read any of the Expanse short stories?
No, not a single one yet.
That's understandable. I didn't read any of them until I finished the book series. I don't think you need to read them, but I do think Nemesis Games is better if you have read at least one of them. That being one called The Churn. Because that gives the backstory to Amos Burton, and that's brought into focus in this story, in this particular book a lot. Amos is a really good part of this book, but more surprising than anything is the fact that like Alex actually gets to be a character instead of like a side background guy, and you're like, oh, whoa, he can actually be a character. That's cool.
And that's what's really important sometimes in a book series, is when you give time to people that seem to start off as just side characters, and you give them so much character development, you almost love them as much as sort of the original core cast. Speaking of which...
Yeah, here we go.
The Last Command by Timothy Zorn. Geordi, this is the end to what was the grand relaunch of the Star Wars EU multimedia project in the early 90s, and kicked off wave after wave of book series coming out, just building on these characters. And so many characters in the series became such favourites that they basically get top billing further down the line. Like, characters like Mira Jade, spoke to her in the previous series, she becomes like one of the headliners. Absolutely beloved.
That's not surprising.
What did you think of this book, Geordi? Come on, just... Does it finish the trilogy in style, or a sad whimper?
Oh yeah, it definitely ends the trilogy in style. I can see why you keep mixing up which things happen in which order, because I feel like it really is, as you say, one cohesive narrative, beginning, middle, and end. It feels very fluid the way it runs through. There's no stops and starts. So yeah, it feels cohesive, it feels smooth, it feels exciting. Is the end a bit abrupt? Yes, a little bit. I have to agree with that. I do wish there was a little bit more time to wrap things up and let them unfold. But then again, that you can see the exact same thing about The Return of the Jedi.
The Emperor is dead. Let's have a party.
Exactly. Duncan, what did you think of it?
I loved it. I really do. The Last Command, I think, brings together the plot threads set up throughout this trilogy so beautifully. Not only that, but it does such a good job, I think, of being kind of forward looking. And you're right, the ending is a bit abrupt. I feel that. I wish everything had a Return of the King style ending. Like, when you finish a master series and you're like, and that's it. But the characters, I need to know their retirement plans. But I really enjoyed this book. I really enjoyed the fact that we see some really pivotal moments and scenes that kind of reverberate down throughout Star Wars, namely the birth of two key characters.
Yeah, I bet.
Such an important moment. And what I really love about this is that in this moment, I'm referring to the Solo twins. These two babies that you see in this book, you legitimately get to watch grow up throughout the rest of the book series. They go through, and I mean completely grow up. There are books where they're toddlers, and they're like, there are books where they're like small children. There's the Young Jedi Knight series where they're like in their early teens, all the way through until you're reading like the New Jedi Order, and they're young adults and they're at the forefront of events.
That sounds so
cool.
All
the way through to the Legacy, where they're, I was about to say almost, they're kind of basically the main characters. Like, one of the main things that I saw we kind of miss out when we get to things like the sequel trilogy is that you come in and Ben Solo, Kylo Ren, is already ready where he's at.
Yeah.
Whereas this allows us to see that entire growth to a character getting somewhere similar. Anyway,
that sounds so completely awesome, because it feels like something which I've always wanted and have always been denied in a story. People who listen to the podcast know I'm a pretty, you know, I was about to say pretty big, but actually I'm a moderately big anime fan. I don't spend anywhere near as much time as I used to watching it. But something which has always been promised to me is the idea of the next generation. And that never feels more real than in, say, Dragon Ball. Because at a certain point in Dragon Ball, the main character, Son Goku, his son takes over as the hero. So Gohan's the hero now, not Goku. But then Goku comes back and he's the hero again. And he has another kid, Goten. But there's no way that Goten's ever going to be the hero, because he's just like this one-note character. It's always Goku. Goku always ends up being the hero again. And it really, I, like so many other Dragon Ball fans, be like, I wish that he'd committed to Gohan being the hero. That would be a really interesting way to take the story. Like, just Goku just doesn't feature anymore, or he's a background character, or he can't interact with the world in a tangible way, and he can only act as a sort of a guide. But no, he's always the hero. It'd be so cool to see that actual passing of the torch.
I'm not going to give you false expectations that the Star Wars EU old legend series fully does that. It does get iffy down the road, but it certainly gives it a damn good shot.
All I know, Duncan, is that eventually Chewbacca will be crushed by a moon.
Okay, Geordie, some of us are still scarred by that. It takes a while.
And I think there are extragalactic plant piloting people.
Also, a thing that happens down the line. But that's many years out. That's a decade out from this book being written, Geordie. So back to Last Command. Like I said, we get some big events happen here. But also the narrative of this book, it's nice. It's the culmination of Thrawn's plot. And Thrawn's plot hasn't gone exactly to plan. You know, our heroes have cut him off at certain points. Not everything's been a full-on victory. So we really see what his sort of next step is. And Geordi, can I talk about the whole Coruscant siege thing that
happens? Yes, absolutely.
This is such a cool kind of sci-fi notion that I really love. So in this book, we get a scene where Thrawn's like, right, I need to take the capital out of the war. This is the heart of the Republic. This is where all the hero characters are. I want to lock that down, but I don't have the ships to do it. I'm not the Empire. Well, I am the Empire. I don't have the manpower to like win through force alone. I've got to use cunning. And there's this brilliant plan that our villain has, which shows sort of his kind of schemes and his strategies. He basically does something where he just floods, or makes the heroes think, he's flooded the atmosphere with asteroids. Except they're invisible. He's coated asteroids in this sort of anti-detection, invisibility material. It's, I'm not going to lie, it's a bit of science in Star Wars, which is a bit loose. It's more science fantasy, as we've discussed.
It's a cloaking device.
But he doesn't have the resource to actually do this. So he just sets up, I think it's like 21, but because they're invisible, he has all of his ships like false fire or false discharge. So the heroes think there are hundreds in the atmosphere. And I think this is such a cool idea of a guy who has limited resources thinking, hey, how can I maximize this strategy? How do you lock down a planet with not enough resource?
And the reason it works is that the threat of a single asteroid is so astronomically high, it's an existential threat. They can't risk it even for a second, lowering the planetary shield in case one falls down. So even though they're like, this has to be a bluff, it has to be. They cannot possibly risk it. Because even if there aren't 24 of them, there are 26 of them, and two crept through. That's millions dead.
Again, great time to have read Nemesis Games in the Expanse series.
Exactly! I was really excited about your reading this at the exact same time, because when I got to that bit, I was like, damn, Duncan is getting a flash of a past here. Not to give any proper spoilers for Nemesis Games, but there's a similar threat presented in that book.
So, a good threat. And this allows Thrawn, our villain, to kind of go and launch his galactic takeover and his all his plans all over the place.
That's right. And there's a really interesting thing that you have here. And again, it's what we've talked about several times before. Thrawn as the evil genius is really convincing here, because he's utilizing stuff he didn't know he would have. So it's not like, you know, maybe he came up with this plan years ago and he's been working towards it this whole time, being like, I need to get Dark Forces, I need to get my cloning tanks, great, I need to get all that stuff. He did not know he was going to get a Dark Jedi. And he did not know that he was going to be able to pull off this really interesting gambit. And this is something which I never considered possible for in a sort of sci-fi story. But so carefully set up with all this different information, the way in which Jedi Masters are set up within Book One to be able to coordinate the actions of others to immense precision through mind control, the way in which the cloaking device is explained away as a piece of useless technology because it makes you invisible, but it also makes you blind, you can't see. Unless you happen to be a Jedi carefully coordinating with someone else. And the way this all plays off, it's all just part of a trick he can do. Like a little magic trick. Where he convinces convinces the Republic that he can shoot through planetary defense grids. He parks a spaceship underneath one, and he fires a laser at the shield that is perfectly aimed at one of his own ships, which is cloaked, and then that ship at the exact same time fires off a laser from inside. So it looks like the laser has just gone straight through.
It's the same sort of setup we saw in Book One with the slave ship systems. We see this sort of technology and these sci-fi elements laid down in sort of their mundane settings. Mm-hmm. And then it's revealed how it all fits together into an elaborate villain's plot.
Exactly. You're using stuff that has at this point become familiar in an interesting, creative way. It's the sort of thing which people tell me Brandon Sanderson's really good at, but I haven't seen him be really good at yet.
One day, we'll get there.
One day. Something else which is really interesting is, what's it called? I was about to say Delta Green, but that's not it.
Delta Source.
Duncan and I have been playing the RPG Delta Green recently, and we're both enjoying it a lot. So it's not that. Delta Source, which is the spy which Thrawn has in within Coruscant somewhere, who's gathering information. And they are, and somehow he's able to get the source and no one knows what it is. And the whole time I'm thinking, it's so obviously Winter. It's so obviously Winter. Like all this trilogy, I'm like, yeah, we get it. This lady, suspicious as hell, suddenly shows up, has an eidetic memory. No way. She's totally evil. What did you think, Duncan? Do you remember who you thought Delta Source was?
I mean, I can't. I'm trying to think when I first read this book series, because that was quite a few years ago. I imagine I thought it must be one of like the generals. It was going to be the reveal that someone who was on their side like the whole time, like someone really close, would be like, oh no, I've actually sold out to the Empire because I don't like the way we've built the Republic. Like someone who maybe was so frustrated with like the other counselors and the slow mechanisms of the Republic who would just go, sod it, I see the benefits now.
I really did want it to be Mon Mothma. I thought that would be so crazy, but I knew it wasn't. But I was like, oh, I hope it is. That would be a crazy for Timothy Zahn to be like, ah ha ha ha, you can't use this character the way you thought you could of a Star Wars writers.
But what it turns out to be, another great example of Timothy Zahn introducing an element in sort of an innocuous way, and then it working into the sci-fi schemes and plots. Geordi, it's a plant.
It's a tree. It's a magic emotion reading tree. It turns out it's like a fake tree that has like it's all of its limbs and branches are actually tiny microphones.
So as I understand, it's sort of this tree that's introduced earlier on where it changes its colour based on sort of the vibrations and like the attitudes of people around it. And it's introduced, I think, in the very first book as just this sort of like, look how opulent Coruscant is. And then it works out that in its roots it's like a tiny transmitter.
The one disappointment I had is that they didn't use it to then plant false information. But then I later realized, like, but they had to dig it up to prove that it is like a microphone, and it would have heard itself being dug up. So I realized that, yeah, you couldn't use it to trick Thrawn into thinking something that isn't true. It just wouldn't work.
So moving off the kind of the villainous schemes of Thrawn, because we've well established this guy's great. And just before we jump onto the main hero, just because you mentioned her and brought her up, Winter, because we haven't talked about her yet.
No, we haven't actually.
A character that comes out of nowhere that we're told has a backstory with Princess Leia. It does relatively little, I think.
Yeah. She's literally like a personal assistant. She's a PA. Her job is to remember things for Princess Leia because she has a perfect memory. A thing which I would be annoyed about existing in anything that wasn't a fantasy novel because, sure, she's a magic woman who can remember everything. That's not a real thing. It doesn't actually exist, but hey-ho. She works in the book to be just like a helpful character there. She doesn't do a great deal to change things around. She's there for like a fight scene to back them up. But she's mostly there to be like a babysitter, to be honest. Like once Jason and... What's your name? Jaina?
I pronounce it Jaina, but...
Yeah, Jaina. Once Jason and Jaina are there, and also, come on, you can't name your kids something so similar. That's absurd.
Absolutely.
These are my children, Felix and Philippa.
Luke and Leia. Stupid naming schemes.
Oh, shit, you're right. I forgot about that. Okay, never mind. You got me. So.
You're right. She's kind of a glorified babysitter, and that's a role she exhibits for, like, I would say, another 8 books. She's definitely an example of, we praise so much Zorn's writing and the side characters he adds to the Star Wars. Winter is one of those ones where I just go, doesn't really do anything, and I don't think anyone really knows what to do with this character. Not that she never does anything. Certainly, quite a bit further down the line, she does get involved a bit more. But this is one of the ones I'm like, this could have been another droid, and functionally, why not be C-3PO? Surely C-3PO has an eidetic memory. He's a robot.
I would not trust C-3PO to carry my baby.
There's scenes later on where I think they do basically leave R2-D2 and C-3PO to do the nannying, and they're always hilarious.
I would trust R2-D2 to be a responsible nanny, but I also would not put him in that position because I feel like he would get into too many adventures.
Mate, trust me. Once you've read C-3PO and R2-D2 take the Solo children to the zoo, just whole new perspective.
That's good fun, actually. That sounds nice. We spoke briefly about... We spoke for a while about Thrawn and his plans, because we always do in these things, because they're very interesting aspects of the books. And what we're talking about now is how they fail. So you said earlier, Duncan, that little by little, the heroes have managed to put little cracks in his plan. And the way this tends to work out is that they just win a little bit more than he can take away from them. So with Dark Force, he doesn't get all the ships he wants. He gets most of them, doesn't get all of them. And then later, Leia, like, secretly, like, wins over one of the people on his side onto her side. And funny enough, like, that doesn't... I mean, it plays a crucial role, but it isn't, like, this big, global, sweeping result. It's pivotal, and it's important. But it was interesting to me that it isn't, like, it's not like the Ewoks showing up in Return of a Jedi. It's not this, like, absolutely titanic thing that changes a scenario. It basically just comes down to one element, which is that one guy is in the right place at the right time.
You speak to this particular character. This is a Noguri character that Leia wins over. But I'd actually argue the whole series and the victory that our heroes gain is on the same principle. You know, the character of Card, the smuggler... Firstly, our heroes win him to their side in earlier books, and his sort of plot arc in this story is to win other smugglers over to their side. And I'd even argue that Mara Jade, it's all about Luke fully winning her over.
It's all about the power of compassion. Leia puts herself in danger by going to see the Noguri in the previous book, and the reward for that, and the reward being like for her kindness and her compassion in revealing the way in which the Empire has tricked them, that it culminates in them coming to her side. They treat Card with trust and compassion and respect, something he never gets from the Empire, and he becomes an ardent soldier on their side. You know, once he gets pushed far enough, he says, despite everything, yes, I am on your side now. As much as I don't want to be another bleeding heart sucker like Han Solo, you got me. I'm with the Republic. and Mara Jade, of course. Like, Luke trusts her again and again, despite every bit of common sense saying, no, you cannot trust this woman. She wants to kill you. She won't stop talking about how she wants to kill you. And yet, compassion.
To me, this is such good Star Wars. This is Timothy Zahn really showing that he has grasped like the core message. Because that's what the original trilogy is. Well, yeah, no, I think that's what it is.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, absolutely.
It's about winning Vader back. It's like Luke going in there and be like, I will show compassion. He's my father. I can win him back to my side. That's the story.
Yeah. A Jedi fights only to defend himself. He never attacks.
Is that something we see in all other Star Wars media?
No.
I get it, you got to change the message up. But this is a great example of keeping the same message, but instead of having it in this one pivotal sense, you see it be really kind of exemplified through lots of different characters. And I think that's what makes this particular trilogy work really well. So yes, our heroes, they're being compassionate, they're being the good guys, and they've got their own missions and quests to go on. Now, I generally say that this book kind of breaks down probably over three characters or three groups more than anything else. You've got Leia back on Coruscant. You've got Luke, Han, Mara Jade and Lando and Chewie going off on their mission to fight the Dark Jedi. And a big bit of this book, and maybe a bit more than I actually remember, a lot of this is about Card and his turning the smugglers to his side.
I found it really interesting. I pointed this out to you, Duncan, in the weeks in between us reading. But the back of the blurb of my version of this book says, and Han and Chewie have a mission to go out and recruit a group of smugglers to their side so they can win the war. And that does not happen in this book. The blurb is just straight up telling me a lie. Like, that's Card. It's not Han Solo. I think that was written by AI. I genuinely do. There's no way a human being who read this book could write that sentence.
I genuinely think it comes down to the fact, though, that if you wrote in the back and Card goes to say, get some people on his side, people are like, who's he?
That's true. Who the fuck is that? I'm not reading this book. I want to read about Han Solo.
It's a shame, but it's the case. And ultimately, you know, covers and blurbs, they're there to sell copies.
But I'm not there to lie to you. That's not fair. But yes, so Card's part of a story is it's really surprising, as you say, that this character who is introduced essentially as an antagonist in the first book, now he's the principal hero. I think he's the most important character in this story, aside from Mara Jade. I think that the rest of the main cast, you said, Duncan, that lays down the line, these characters rise to fall. I think they're already there. Because Mara Jade is the one who makes all of the big crucial actions at the end, and Card makes all of the big important decisions.
So let's go then, and let's end on Mara Jade, because I think obviously that's the climax that I really want to just dive into, because it's so beautiful.
It's great.
I love that scene.
It's really great.
Card. Is Card Han Solo 2.0, Geordie?
Basically, yeah. I feel like Timothy Zahn really liked Han Solo's arc, and why wouldn't you? It's the strongest arc in any Star Wars film. Han Solo going from renegade to hero. It's what Star Wars, it's Star Wars at its very core. So of course you want to hack into that again and try it out once more. This is Han Solo like 15 years down the line from A New Hope. You know, you're seeing him as a more established element of a criminal underworld. Could a man who was in Han Solo's shoes once, and then went further than him, and wasn't redeemed, and didn't get set back onto his track, could he still be redeemed? Apparently the answer is yes. And he leads a band of merry renegades to thwart Thrawn. That's a tricky thing to say.
And I like these scenes, and I think this is a really good kind of litmus test of how successful this book's being. Because I think if you were reading this trilogy and you got to these scenes and you were like, ugh, why are we spending so much time with him? I want to get back to Han and Luke. Then I would say Zahn's failed. Like, that would be such a good marker of how well the author's kind of developed his own characters. And the fact that I personally did not feel that, I'm like, yes, this is your success story.
Yeah, there's a great bit in it. Okay, what's that character's name? Is it Nielsen?
Yeah, let's go with Nielsen.
Yeah, Nielsen is this character who's been introduced since the start of the second book. he's another criminal element. Again, like, he's like, so if Talancard is Han Solo 15 years down the line, Nielsen is more of a Lando 15 years down the line. Like, he's more treacherous than Han. Like, he tricks people, and he's more embedded in the criminal underworld. And he's a ship thief, but he works for Thrawn, like, a lot. And he does it willingly. At some points, he is being, like, threatened and blackmailed, but he keeps coming back to support Thrawn because he thinks that's the winning side. A really pivotal moment in this book is that it's not Thrawn's mistake which leads to his downfall, it's Nielsen's. Nielsen is the one who, like, sets up this trap where he tries to ambush these smugglers in order to make himself a part of their group and make sure they can trust him. And what it does is it rallies the smugglers against Thrawn and the Empire. And Thrawn is so furious about this that he's going to kill Nielsen until he can, unless he can set things right. And Duncan, I want to know what you think about this scene, because I have mixed feelings about it.
The threatening scene, or Nielsen's plans?
The plan, and the fact that it's this mistake, like Nielsen's mistake, not Thrawn's, that leads to his downfall.
So this is quite interesting. So there's an element here. So Thrawn, firstly, I think this actually shows Thrawn being quite clever, because what Thrawn tries to do in this, he comes with a plan where Nielsen's tried to get some stormtroopers to attack all the rebels, not the rebels, the smugglers, and it goes wrong. And Thrawn goes, I've got a plan. That was such a terrible attack. It was such an awful plan, Nielsen. No one would believe I had any part in it. So you'll go make it out like Card did this, and then that'll scatter the smugglers again. They'll turn on him and turn on the Republic. I'm the reasonable one.
I like that scene too. But again, that fails because of Nielsen, not because of Thrawn. And what I'm really saying is that I do feel like already Zorn is quite precious about Thrawn, and he doesn't want him to make any mistakes. Like, the Emperor makes a mistake. The Emperor doesn't believe in Vader's power to be redeemed. That's his fatal flaw. That's why he's defeated. But Thrawn never really makes a proper mistake.
It's almost like his only mistake is delegation. He delegated to an incompetent idiot.
But no, but in this scene, he didn't delegate. Like, this was happened in spite of his orders. I wish that he had delegated. I wish that it had been a crucial mistake of pride. Like, there is an element later, which we will get to, which is Thrawn's mistake. Similar to the Emperor, he believes absolutely in someone's loyalty and is betrayed. That's a good scene. That's cohesive. That feels thematic. I don't like this element of Nielsen.
You say it sort of robs Thrawn's agency to his own downfall.
No, it's just it makes him too...
perfect.
Cool. Too good. Too perfect. Exactly. Yeah. Like, I feel like Zorn is already too hooked on Thrawn.
I can definitely see that. I do think this book does keep it to the right side of that line. Not something that necessarily happens later. But I can see that. I do feel maybe it would have been nice if Thrawn had made some level of actual plans. Like, his plans had gone wrong. I don't know. It didn't bother me as much. I'm not saying what you're saying
Fair
is
enough.
It's probably objectively correct. I'm saying I'm like, yeah, I see that. I don't mind. But, you know, it's not an unfair thing to say.
Okay, we just looked it up. It's not Nielsen. His name was Niles. Niles Ferrier. So we weren't that far off. If he had a kid, he would be Nielsen.
I'm just looking through the text and going, they actually just call him Ferrier for the most part. But
they do, so I have no idea why I went to his first name instead. Yeah, he's always called Ferrier.
This character, to be honest, I think was a bit limp as well. You say he's there to kind of take the fall for Thrawn's, to be yes. The person who falls other than Thrawn. And that just making just a little bit like, why is this incompetent guy doing such important work?
Yes, I agree. Thrawn should not rely on this guy. That being said, I do like the scene where his plan falls apart. And I love the way... I love a scene like this, where a liar is caught. So I don't like a scene where, like, the hero who's been lying the whole time is caught, is found out, and then there's a whole scene where people are like, you lied to us, you betrayed us, you know, chicken run shit. What I really like is a scene where a villainous character is caught out in a lie, finally. It's the best part of, like, you know, an Agatha Christie novel. The mystery is revealed, the murderer is caught, and you see the pieces come into place. This scene where Niles Ferrier, his lie in his attempt to entrap...
Card
fails because other people are paying attention and he's trustworthy enough and he's proved himself enough that he can get them to see some reason. That's good stuff. I love that.
That's really fun. I think what kind of just, and like, this is a fun scene of this lie at the table. I think Ferrier, he's sort of, I love him calling Ferrier now, Niles, whatever. His sort of thing is the fact that he's just that little bit too incompetent. He kind of leans for me a little bit back into that more cartoony, comic booky vibe for Star Wars, which is fun. I just don't think it kind of matches the rest of the Thrawn trilogy. In this particular scene, I like it. It's his own hubris here is the fact that he's a swindler. He's a bit of a fast talker and he just doesn't keep his mouth shut. Like, if he just sat more, he probably would have got away with it.
Yeah, I like that a lot as well. I really like that element. All right, let's hone in on our actual heroes, because we barely talked about Han, Luke, and Leia. I think Leia's part in the story is really solid. I like the bits where she's endangered and she lacks agency. I like the parts where she is empowered and she has agency. Her under threat and her in control are both really engaging scenes. And the fact that she gets to, like, charge in at the end as the cavalry, it's a nice change of pace. You know, she's the one who's like, okay, the boys have got themselves in a situation, I need to get them out of it. It did irk me a little bit that when Han and Luke and Lando, they all go to this planet to sneak in, they park the Falcon 8 days away from the location and they have to hike all the way through. And that's absurd. They've never done that in Star Wars history. They've never had to park ages away and have to walk for like a week to get somewhere.
No, completely. It did really feel like there was just some timeline that Zorn was putting together for like Thrawn's plot and everyone else and went,
absolutely. It needs to happen so that Leia can show up at the end to save the day. That's why they have to hike for 8 days.
And it just seemed ridiculous. You look at Endor, and I know they had the shuttle and whatever, but they're still pretty close to the base. Or a more extreme case would be, and do you know, even in the, like, the prequels, like when I'm thinking of that scene in episode 2 when Obi-Wan Kenobi like goes into Geonosis. Like, he literally parks just on the other side of a cliff ledge or behind a rock to the enemy fortress. I know in a movie it's like where you want to show time a bit faster, but that's where these books come from. That's the world we've established. No one would have questioned it if they were like a days away. One night scene.
And they park far enough away that it's 8 days of travel across a forest because they have to keep lifting R2-D2 over roots. Don't bring him. Leave him on the ship. That's fine. Like, come on. We don't always need R2-D2 to be in this picture, right?
Yeah, but they need him. He's the only one with the little sticky thing to open doors.
But we know that's not true because Han Solo did it in Return of the Jedi.
Very fair. This is maybe.
And Mara's a slicer.
Do you know what? No, she is. Oh no, that is a bit ridiculous. And it's not like R2 brings much in the way of character to these scenes either. It's not like, oh my god, R2, you said that. Thank you. Now we can have our heart-to-heart moment. I think it would have worked if we just had at least one like night, so you can have that campfire scene. But that's all you needed.
That's right. It's all you need. But it has to be done this way so that, you know, you can have Leia come to the rescue. But it doesn't make any sense for one reason only. If things went tits up, they'd have nowhere to go. You need, and they don't even leave someone on the Falcon. Like, leave one person, Chewie or Lando, on the Falcon so that they can swoop in at the last second to save you. But they don't leave anyone there. And that was just, it doesn't ruin the book or anything, but it's just, it's not acceptable from a writer like Timothy Zorn.
You're right. It falls short of kind of the standards that have been set in this book trilogy. There are definitely dumber things that have happened in Star Wars films and Star Wars Legends. But definitely, for this book trilogy, this is one of those ones where the nitpickers, you can just really pull this plan apart. I'm like, guys, you're acting dumb here. So we've moved off Leia a little bit.
In all of the other books, the characters are like smarter than they tend to be in canon, like in the movies. Like, they're all super geniuses, and now they make this huge mistake, it stands out a lot. But yeah, sorry, interrupted you. Please keep going.
Just want to jump back on Leia. You said you really like it that she gets to be the cavalry. That's a great scene. One other scene I really like that really exemplifies Leia yet again as the counselor, the negotiator, a key part of her character, is the scenes with, I believe it's Bel Iblis.
But yes, it's tricky.
Thank you. I really enjoy this. It's a really nice sort of small side moment of Leia once again trying to bring people together and be that kind of politically active individual. It's something exemplifying her own strengths. And this is a scene with like a general who fell out with the rebellion in the old days and they're like, come on, come back on board. And you have scenes with Leia trying to bring this person over. And I really enjoy the fact that she doesn't quite fully do it, but she's still trying. She tries several different tacks and like appealing to him in different ways. And I think in the end, it's Mon Mothma walks in and is like, I'm asking you pretty please, 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 please.
No, it's not like that actually. And that's important to this scene, which is that, and basically what's been set up since book two is that Bel Iblis, basically he wants to help, but he has too much pride and his pride won't permit him to help without being asked. But, and the issue is that it's actually quite nuanced. He wants Mon Mothma to ask him for help, but he also understands that if he's asked for help, then he's allowed his prides to win, essentially, and so he's in this great state of conflict. If Mon Mothma asks, it's politically bad for both of them. One of them needs to take the step forward. And the thing that changes the scene is after Leia has asked for his help and he's basically laid out his emotional stakes of the scene, Mon Mothma shows up and she's about to ask for his help and say, we need you. I was wrong to cast you out, essentially. And before she can do so, he says, I will help. So he jumps ahead of her asking for help because he's acknowledged, yes, you showing up here shows me that you do need my help. You're humble enough to ask for it, but I am going to be compassionate enough to not make you ask for it. I'm going to jump in and help. And it's actually, it feels, I know it's confusing to have me explain it because it is such a wibbly wobbly ego based thing. But it's actually a really touching moment once you've really engaged with these characters and you understand them and you just sort of grok what the relationship is between them, to see someone step up and do something purely for the sake of the unity between them. It's moving.
I feel like I've been a little bit shot down in that because my simplistic reading of the scene. I think the point I was trying to get to is the fact that it's not Leia's being the sort of politician here, but it's ultimately not actually what Leia does. It's a scene that then gets to play out between two other characters. So I like seeing a character, how to put it, it would be too much for Leia just to sweet talk him into it or logic him into it or something. I like the fact that it allows the characters come out, him to explain his feelings and emotions, but then it actually plays out separate to Leia. I think it's a really good way to use Leia.
Leia facilitates the scene.
Yes, perfect phrasing.
Like, she's there so the scene can happen, but she isn't the instigator or the closer of
that
the scene.
That is perfect. It's taking Leia to facilitate the scene. She's the main character, the lead from the trilogy, but she's facilitating this side character and an original character to have their moment.
And therefore deepen, like, the complexity of stuff that's already happened. Like, the resistance and the rebellion is now, like, more complicated than it ever was before. Because you have these old alliances which have to, like, be renegotiated now that they're in power. Interesting. I'm glad. I hope that Bel Iblis is in a bunch of future Star Wars novels, which I won't read!
That has hurt, Jordan. I was not expecting that outburst. You're gonna read that. Come on!
I don't know. Listen, I gotta read some other shit, okay?
You'll be there. You'll be on Audible. You have your credit, Duncan, and you go, oh, X-Wing.
There aren't a lot of Star Wars books on Audible, so they're all the new stuff. And if, funnily enough, Duncan, like, actually, I was gonna mention at the start of the episode. So, Duncan, right before we started recording, whilst I was waiting for recording to start and for you to have your rice or whatever, I was playing guitar. I was practicing. And... one, I was doing very badly. I'm struggling through Fix You by Coldplay. And I tried to find my guitar strap. So I opened up my guitar case, found the pocket where I keep my guitar strap. And do you know what I found inside?
Your Heir to the Empire book.
Yes, I found Heir to the Empire by Timothy Zorn. I was reading it outdoors, practicing guitar, and I put it in there and I forgot. So now I have the entire trilogy.
I'm very happy for you. I also love this image that you kind of go outdoors to the park with your guitar and your Star Wars book. And you're like, yeah. That's how I live my life.
That's how I balance how cool I am with how uncool I am. I'm too worried that people will be too impressed by me going out and playing my guitar in the sun outdoors. And to make sure I balance it out, I get out a Star Wars book so they don't respect me.
You do it well, mate. You do it well. So, back to... Well, actually, not back to. Let's just get to, right. That's all the side plot. That's all the other things going on. The main characters, at last. We've said to them they're on a planet. They're going on for a hike. I'm not going to lie. For the majority of this book, they do not have the most exciting plot. I was more engaged with Card and Leia until we get to the damn climax. Because they're just walking. They're talking. And it's good. But they're walking and talking. They're not having laser fights. They're not having force-offs.
They're having some chit-chats. Mara has been... This is another great thing that Leia does, actually. I know we said we were done talking about her. Leia instigates the redemption of Mara Jade. Like a character whom she has no real reason to know or trust. But because she loves and trusts Luke, and Luke trusts her, she carries on that trust. It's another great message of, you know, respect and trust and love and blah, blah, blah. And she's the one who floats the idea of, hey, did you think maybe that voice in your head that says, you must kill Luke Skywalker and sounds a lot like the Emperor's voice isn't your voice, but it's the Emperor's voice making you do this thing against your will?
I really enjoy this. I really enjoy the fact that we get to see Mara Jade and let's talk about her a bit more. She has a voice that says, the Emperor's voice in her head, kill Luke Skywalker, kill Luke Skywalker.
You must kill Luke Skywalker.
I also love that not only is the Emperor from the grave, supposedly, saying this into her head, he also sends her, like, a propaganda image of how he died.
Know. A deep fake version of his death.
This is brilliant. So, she gets a vision from the Emperor of what actually happened on the Death Star, and instead of the scene of the Emperor zapping Luke on the ground and Darth Vader picking him up and throwing him down the shaft, it's instead Luke and Vader have this moment where they like lock eyes and like, Father, you know what to do. And then they just turn on the Emperor and beat up an innocent old man. The terrors.
Yeah, it is quite clever because he takes the scene of their swords being crossed in front of them and it just like changes from there. You know, it's like, it takes this moment that did happen, and then it just says, like, and then, dot, 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 this thing totally happened. They attacked him. This poor, poor old man.
I just want to get the idea of, like, in timeline, like, was the Emperor, like, during the rest of the fight, was the Emperor like, I better send a different version of it? We can't have done it then, because he wasn't dead yet. He didn't know he was going to die.
He was falling down the shaft. He was running down the shaft. He's like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm about to explode for some reason, but I know what I'm going to do. Mara!
Well, Mara, or maybe the other hands. Something that's not addressed in this book. In the previous book, Thrawn references that there are other hands to the Emperor. Like elite assassins. And I don't think that actually comes up again.
Shoot. I forgot about that.
Oh. Wait and see. I don't think it comes up again. I'm racking my brain at the moment. I'm like, maybe that was just Thrawn trying to get in her head. I think it might have been.
Or they all retired. Like, she was the only one who got the memo about, like, you must kill Luke Skywalker. Or the rest of them got the message like, fuck no, I'm going to go become a Bantha farmer.
Yeah, this is it for me.
Yes, whilst he was falling down that shaft, he got a little to-do list. He first things first, he ticked off, all right, tell Mara Jade to kill Luke Skywalker. And then he transported his brain into some cloning tank somewhere to become a young, hot Darth Sidious. But then he also spent another half of his brain out into a different set of cloning vats to become Snoke, or maybe, I don't know.
Different universes, mate, different continuities, but you're right. Well, that's the only justification, is the fact that he didn't do that while falling down the shaft. Down the shaft he went, I've got a soul jump to my clones over there, and then he was just from a distance like, come on, kill Luke Skywalker, kill Luke Skywalker.
It might have only been a note to himself. He might have been like, oh, I know what I'm going to do next. And it just so happened that Mara picked that up.
Well, whichever way, Mara's doing great. She kind of has this realization that, you know, what does she actually want? And that's really what her character, I feel, is in this. It's about Mara going, I've kind of lived this existence. Is this what I want to do? What do I want now in the wider galaxy, now that I have saw the opportunities? Well, once we've beaten up this old man.
That's right. It's old man beatdown central. Because, and we haven't really mentioned it in this book so far, Joris Sabaoth finally gets to have his chance to be the big villain. He was kind of a bit pathetic in the previous book, to be honest. Like, he's manipulating Luke Skywalker, but he's very easily overcome by Mara Jade when she shows up with one lizard. That's all it takes to beat a Jedi. It's one lizard. But actually, in this book, he's properly menacing. He's really dangerous.
He definitely is. I really enjoy the fact that his character has this continuous face-off with Thrawn about, I mean, in the story, in the, you know, the universe, it's about who really rules the Empire. But it kind of, on a meta level, it's who's the real villain? Who's the real villain of this tale? And obviously,
Thrawn gets to be the villain throughout the previous two books, and this time he's like, no, I'm taking control. I'm seizing the spotlight.
And to a certain extent, he kind of does, because he's the one that gets to have the showdown with the heroes. Thrawn doesn't have a face-to-face.
And for the first time, that's right, and for the first time, Thrawn's machinations are bested. You know, like, the scene where Joris Sabaoth outthinks Thrawn, that's really interesting. That's really engaging, because you've had this character who's been manipulated every turn up to this point. He gets to win through. And to be honest, I kind of wish it was Joris Sabaoth's, like, stepping into his plans which cause things to go awry. That's not the case. It just, period, full stop, isn't. It's Card who rallies the smugglers to come to the rebels' aid at this battle, which they just so happen to have sort of stumbled their way into. I do like the lead up to that scene, but still, it's very funny that once again, the things are resolved in Star Wars by humongous coincidences. And Leia bringing the Nogiri to her side. That's what undoes him. But Joris Sabaoth winning over, like, he represents a new paradigm which could threaten Thrawn. And, you know, theoretically, Thrawn could win. He could take over Coruscant and then immediately be plunged into a new civil war.
Oh, I definitely think so. In fact, I would love to see that alternative universe. They did some comics called, like, Star Wars Infinities, where it's like the what if of Star Wars. I'd love to kind of see that.
Yeah, but they're really stupid, aren't they?
Yeah, I love them, but you're right, they're absolutely... If you ever want to see Yoda pilot the Death Star and crash it into Coruscant...
Killing billions. Trillions, maybe.
Or better yet, if you ever want to see Leia go to Dagobah... So, you know, we don't have that worse. So we've got Sabaoth, and I do really enjoy this. I like this paradigm, though, because this is a paradigm that I think really gets separated out in a lot of further Star Wars, because there's two kind of villains. And in the original trilogy, they're merged in one. The Emperor represents the Empire and the Sith. I like the fact that it's two camps. Mm. You've got to deal with the Imperial Remnant and you've got to deal with Dark Jedi. Cool. That works. They've got the different method. They've got different approaches. They're doing it for different reasons. And you can kind of fear them for in different ways. Thrawn, yeah, has a military.
Yeah.
But in a room on his own, it's kind of just a bloke.
Absolutely. And the thing is, yeah, he's no physical threat. Joris Sabaoth is a physical threat, but he's also like a creepy horror movie villain, because there's one scene in this that is actually genuinely quite unsettling, where he's mind controlling a general. And I'll tell you, Duncan, I think this one scene did so much more for Star Wars than basically almost anything else in this book, because it goes to show, like, it makes, without being super explicit about it, it draws a line between Jedi and Sith. in a really interesting way. And in a way that favors your camp of it's how you use the Force Awakens. You see Ben Kenobi do a Jedi mind trick where he tricks a stormtrooper into letting him go by. And he says to Luke, this only works in a weak-minded. And this has been taken by people later down the line to be like, okay, anytime you see a Jedi mind trick working, it means that person was an idiot. And a Jedi mind trick could never work on an intelligent person. But in this book, you see that the way Jura Sabaoth uses Jedi mind powers is that he hooks in his claws and he like puppets you like a marionette. And not only is this like evil because you're taking away free will, when he like is controlling someone and he goes into an Isalamari field of anti-force, that person just drops dead. He is so ingrained into them. He's replaced so much of their brain with himself that the moment he loses control, they're dead. He completely rewired that person. And that's gross. It's unsettling. It's creepy.
I really do enjoy seeing this. And I really like the idea, because they do talk about this, is what the Emperor used to do, what he did with Mara Jade. It kind of makes you go, how do these men like rise to power? They were physically in the heads of people. And I wouldn't be surprised when we have scenes of like, because this doesn't get talked about a lot, but like when the Emperor first comes to power and Palpatine's rise in the prequels and he's got all these senators on his side voting for him, it makes you go, how much of his mind powers are literally inside these people at this point?
I have different feelings about that. I would kind of take away from the whole allegory of the prequels as a sort of Adolf Hitler meets George Bush style politicking, but that's for another episode when we talk about the prequels and shit.
But you're right, it's an opportunity. And this also feeds in, because again, this is a really creepy scene, but we see this is where it's been building. You know, he wants to dominate, he wants to rule over people. And this sort of shows the actual extent of what he means by that.
He wants Yes, and it's really interesting.
And it also suggests, though, you see it on a, again, things being layered in earlier, part of the Grand Thrawn's plan of like a ship firing at the same time to go for the shield, like the synchronization, is part of that kind of mind control of he's got his hands on the guy in the ship who's shielded and knows how to make him press the button. Like that's how his efficiency kind of comes out, because he's physically directing the soldiers. Jordy, can I just ask, before you jump on, you've mentioned there, and I don't know how much we talked about this, the Isalamari? Isalamari? The Force.
Isalamari.
So, what do you think of them?
I don't like the implications they have for Star Wars. I mean, I feel like every single book from now on should contain them in basically every scene. Like, they're such a groundbreaking element of the series that to suddenly pretend they didn't exist feels like it would be impossible. They would have to be written out in a really convincing way. Do they feature a lot in future books?
Oh, no. But yeah.
That's what I thought you'd say, because they're so powerful in terms of getting in Luke's way, it feels like they just would ruin the spirit of the game.
Definitely. There are other examples further down the line of things being like force resistant or force repellent, which sort of speaks to that midichlorian ideas a bit early.
Boo!
I never like them. I just think it takes away from the more mythical, magical side of it. And you're absolutely right. As soon as they exist, you're like, well, because they like help you ward off mind control, you think like every senator would walk around with one of these around their necks.
And they're not even seem to be that hard to keep alive. They can like transport them around places. They have like nutrient cages where like they get fed all the stuff they should get from the trees they live on. So clearly, like, they figured out how to tame them really fast. It's not convincing that they just like would vanish from the story from here on, but I can see why he introduced the story, because it's really necessary for like the final scenes of the book. However, I wish that it had been the Kyber crystal, you know? I wish it was just a MacGuffin. It's an one item which can be used to stop the Force, and it's magic. Or it's the Darksaber. It's a thing. It's a magical item which blocks the Force. That, I think, would be much more suitable as a tool, because you could break it at the end. And there, it's not in the story anymore. We threw it into Mount Doom.
I see your point. It saves you having to have this, one, this weird explanation of how they came to be, and two, what happens after. It would have been a bit neater.
Yeah, exactly. Because he comes up with an excuse why they wouldn't be in the story before, but not why they shouldn't be there afterwards.
Sorry, guys. Let's get on to our climax, because it's really good. We referenced it at the start of this episode. There's a clone, Luke.
It's such a good scene. I genuinely gasped when I read it. Mar and Luke show up in the throne room. Again, another throne room. To face off against Joris Sabaoth, and as they're about to beat up an old man yet again, he turns off all the Isalamari. He kills them all in one fell swoop. And now he reveals that he has had a clone of Luke made. When he said, "Luke will be my servant," he wasn't referring to the real Luke. Well, he was, but he's given up on that. He's referred to Luke. All of the clones have a double U in their name. It's a bit silly. But Luke shows up and he's wielding Anakin Skywalker's old lightsaber. And he was cloned from the severed hand that was left, fell from Cloud City. Duncan, do you remember when all of the people were complaining about Rey getting Anakin Skywalker's lightsaber and like, where did he find it? This was written in the 90s.
It just is. They found it. It was in a dumpster.
Yeah, they found a hand. Fuck you. They have the Force. Anyway, yes, Luke shows up and he has a showdown with Luke. And it's a good little sword fight they have. And the moment he's introduced and Mara's in the scene, you go, oh, okay. Yeah, that's really neat.
Kill Luke Skywalker.
You must kill Luke Skywalker. Well, look at that. There's a spare.
I really like also, an implication here, Geordie, with the clone Luke. That because this clone Luke, the hand, the lightsaber, this was on Palpatine's old secret vault. So I really like the idea that Palpatine probably also had this as like a backup plan. Oh yeah, if they both end up dying on me, I'll just create a clone Luke.
There we go, easy peasy. Turns out cloning Jedi is super easy.
So yes, she must kill him. I like a proper laser fight. Lightsaber fight.
Yeah, nice lightsaber duel. I was wondering how they'd incorporate it, because I was like, there's no way they could make poor Joris Sabaoth fight. He's an old man. It wouldn't be very exciting just to push him down the stairs.
First one of the books trilogy to see a lightsaber versus a lightsaber, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, absolutely. Who else is it going to be? So what happens to Anakin's lightsaber in this scene? Does that mean Luke gets it back, or does it break?
I believe. Oh, no, let me. Sorry, no.
I think Mara picks it up in the scene, so it definitely survives.
I am looking up in. So I've got to write Legends to specify.
I don't think anything does happen to it. I think it's just around.
If I'm not. I am just going to hunt through. I imagine it ends up going eventually to one of the children.
Yeah, to a Skywalker.
Yes, if I'm not mistaken, Luke from... Oh, no, sorry. We are completely forgetting. He gives it to Mara.
So he does give it to Mara.
Yes.
That would make sense. Yeah, okay, good. She doesn't have it in the future comics, though, because I've seen her lightsaber later, so I guess she also drops it somewhere.
I believe the implication it does kind of go down the Skywalker line. I do think it is in Legacy, which is like 150 years later. So they keep hold of it. It goes down the family. It's an heirloom.
The final fight with Joris Sabaoth, it's very great. It does a lot of the stuff in this book, which is rock solid. I'm not going to lie. I got a little bit fed up of the scenes with Lando and Chewbacca. I was just like, hurry up. Just hurry up. I wouldn't find that exciting. But everyone gets to contribute. Like Han and Leia get to have their part in the final duel in these small but very important ways. like Leia gets to lend her like force powers to Luke and Mara to help them. I like the fact that even Card and his Vore scars, his force dogs, get to play their role. A dog gets electrocuted and you're like, no! And Mara gets the finishing blow because she's the main character.
She does, right through Saboa's chest. I really enjoy this. I think it's really nice that Luke, once again, isn't made to cut down the villain. I don't know if that's to kind of...
That's true. I hadn't even realised that.
If this is about keeping his character, or what this kind of means for Luke, or they just wanted to give Mara a big moment.
No, totally. I like the fact. I mean, I said when we were reading book one, the scene where he chops down like 12 Nogira, I'm like, that's not Luke. That's not him at all. You don't get it. But the fact that in these books, he's way more peaceful and wise, and he's not aggressive, and he fights to defend himself, and the scene where he like defeats Luuk, it's not by being aggressive, it's by being clever. I love that. It's brilliant.
It's really nicely done. And we get this big villain, we get this action scene, and if I'm not mistaken, then we cut away. And then we cut back to Thrawn for Thrawn's ending. Oh, it was so artistically done.
That's good. Yes, it's a good final line. Wedge has been this small POV character for the latter half of this book, where he has like linked up with the smugglers, and again, through faith and trust, they say, we'd like to lend you a hand, and because he's good and trusting, he listens to them, and that allows him to turn the tide in this one battle against the Imperials, who would have ambushed the Rebel fleet and destroyed them. And there's this moment where Thrawn, once again, he's been outfoxed, he's been out-tricked, but he's unflappable. Anyone else would go crazy in this moment, and instead he orders a retreat. Oh, not a retreat, sorry. No. He says, this is a bad situation, but it's far from insurmountable. And the understanding is that he's about to come up with some brilliant gambit that's going to help the Imperials turn the tide yet again and win. And it's at this exact moment that the Nogiri, or whatever, his name is not supposed to be pronounceable, stabs him straight through the back. And that's the pivotal contribution which Leia made by turning the Nogiri. You know, this guy has been loyal, he's been by Thrawn's side throughout the whole thing, he's been his henchman, and then BAM! He betrays him at this pivotal moment, because he's been biding his time, waiting for the crucial moment. And here it is. And now, without Thrawn, Pelion orders the retreat, because he can't see the way through.
I really enjoy the fact that, obviously, we get that for what was Thrawn's weakness? Was it overconfidence? In a way, but it was in a very different way. It wasn't overconfidence in his...
It was a belief in his power of control. That's what I would say was his great flaw. He believed utterly in his ability to control other people.
And I really enjoy the fact that, because the way... It also links into the fact that, why didn't he have control over the Nogiri? Because he just wasn't honest with them. You know, it was that lie that's revealed in the second book, that the Empire's been kind of screwing over this race, taking advantage of them. If they were nicer, you know, that wouldn't have played out that way. So it feeds all kind of back in on itself. And yes, Pelion, who... I love this side character. I really do. I like the fact
that... You've made that very strangely clear.
I really like the fact that it's not this grand defeat. Like I said, it's the loss of that figurehead. It's the loss of the strategy that does them in. You know, Thrawn himself was what was keeping them in the game. And I like the fact that he's just like, okay, guys, let's go. A thing that he does many times.
I have one more thing to say. I am a bit interested to see what the Imperials could possibly be like without a character like Thrawn there, because surely they're just an inconvenience at this point. Like, Pelion is not capable of directing the Imperials yet. And also there's a thing in the future that's like the Hand of Thrawn. I'm like, what on earth could that even be? What could that be?
I mean, I know, but...
I'm sure you do know, Duncan. But, like, he's dead. Unless it's like a... Sherlock Holmes season 4 thing, and like it's a videotape of him that comes back, and like he's not actually back, but he tries to convince people he's back for some reason.
I mean,
it all leads up to a very unsatisfying climax.
I mean, Geordi, the Imperial still have his body, and cloning's a thing.
That's fucking hell. That's such a cheap shot. Okay, well, if that's the case, that sucks. That is literally terrible. So, moving on. Speaking of clones, actually, Duncan, I really, aside from the inclusion of Luke, which I find really interesting and cool, the clones in this book are such a non-element. Like, it's so obvious how terrified Timothy Zahn was to actually depict what a clone is like.
Yes, they're really played down. In fact, the Dark Force, the Cortana fleet that Thrawn gets in the previous book, the focus of that book didn't really feel like it was a major playing piece in this one.
Yeah, it's there, but it doesn't feel that significant.
And you're right, I think there was a concern. I think this was still definitely a time where he was like, I don't want to overcommit because George Lucas hasn't told me. He's not laid it down yet.
Yeah. Who knows what it's going to be? Are clones going to be just one New Zealand guy? Are they going to be a bunch of weird orc monsters? Are they going to be a clone of Anakin Skywalker who can pull around Star Destroyers and pull them into orbits of planets?
The real fundamental difference in the portrayal of clones here and the portrayal of clones we eventually get by the time we get to the Clone Wars
TV series, Palpatine?
Is the fact that these clones are shown to be more like droids. They are there. They are fighters. They're mass production.
I disagree.
Oh,
I mean, no. Yes, conceptually, in terms of the fact they're mass-produced, yes, but a clone never actually appears as a character.
No, that's my point, is the fact that in these books, the clones might as well be an army of robots. But they're not characters.
I see your...
In fact...
Yes, but the way you're saying it makes it sound like that's like a thematic choice, and that's not true. Like, even the idea that just have one scene of someone trying to talk to a clone in like a stormtrooper outfit and it just doesn't respond, like it just looks at them and then it goes back to its world like an automaton, then you would say something about the clones. But all you hear is people go, I don't know about you, but I find them a bit unsettling. And I'm like, why? What about them is unsettling?
No, but there is this detail, I think, and I hope I'm not pulling from a future book. They make it out that you need to clone them in like an anti-force field. That's why they have the creatures, because
that isn't...
It's explained that the Force gets confused that there are two beings the same in the universe, and that makes them go a bit crazy evil.
That is explained, and the fact that clones go insane is thematic and strong. I appreciate that, although it's not actually something that's depicted in any example except for Joris Saboeth. Yes, that is explained that they need to be put into this clone thing, but my point is we don't get to see that on screen. It's explained by characters who don't even see it happen themselves. They just deduce it via clues that, that's what they had to do. They had to get the Yi Salamari and then clone all of the people in this one location because it's completely covered by Yi Salamari, so they cut off on the Force so that they don't get this strange post-birth experience. It's a bit silly.
It's
not game-breaking, but I wish he had just said, this is what clones are like, and I'm prepared to show you, the audience, what a clone's like.
One of the things that when they come to kind of retcon around this is they make a big deal of like, oh, no, this is very specific to the Spartai cloning technique. It's like so accelerated, that's why all these other factors exist. That's sort of the retcon that ends up getting put in place here. That if you grow clones...
Luke, you don't understand. The only way to create a stable clone is for it to be the guy who was in Once Were Warriors. Only he can be cloned!
And you do it gentle cloning is the idea. No, the point I was actually going to make is that particular bit about the Force is what gets dropped later. There's a very clear scene in the Clone Wars where Yoda's like, in the Force, you know, individual luminous beings are you. And he sort of says, you know, you're all individual humans. Even if you were cloned, you're basically, you're just your person. And that's sort of the difference, but you're right. Zahn doesn't bring enough to the clones. And that's why I was sort of disappointed with the hold of the Dark Force a bit, because it's given such weight in the second book. It's the point. And it just doesn't appear.
Yeah, not a significant part of this next book. It just sort of had to happen in a previous one to give the book a climax and something to work with the whole time. Yeah, the idea, in some ways, I do think that if you were, say, to adapt this into a movie, like so many Star Wars fans want, you would really just adapt part one and part two. That was it, part one and part three. You set up, you introduce the characters from the first part, you introduce Card, and then you shove them together. You get Han to convince Card to join his side, and then even maybe he doesn't just convince Card, he convinces all the smugglers at once, and Card is the figurehead of the smugglers joining their side. You know, stuff like that.
I think the only bit from book two that you'd really want to keep is Leia's plot. You take Leia's plot, absolutely. And you have what Leia does in book two happen simultaneously to the events of book one. And then literally just ditch the rest.
Yes, and you would fuse the scenes with Luke and Mara from the first book with scenes of Luke and Mara from the second book, because their interactions and their working together is much more interesting in the next one.
I feel like we ended on a negative note for how much we loved this.
Let's say one more thing we liked about the book and then we'll wrap it up. I like the ending. I like the final page. It is abrupt, but the fact that, like, Luke is back where he started in the first book, on Coruscant, on this one roof where he used to be super depressed, but now he's going to support Mara, who's directionless and lost like he was. Again, thematic, cyclical, we like it. And then he's saying, like, you know, there's a troubling time in the future, but I'm going to do my part in it, and I'm going to build something that, you know, makes the galaxy a better place.
If I'm not mistaken.
And as he's walking off,
oh, yeah. Yes. No. So you're about to say it. You're about to cut it. I was just going to say, Mara gets the final line, and I love it.
And Mara, you know, who has been directionless and was given this purpose before and has yet to decide for herself what she wants to do, as he's leaving with this new direction and this new certainty, she turns back and she says, I'll come with you. And that's such a nice line to end it on. I really wasn't sure how to begin to end it, but saying, like, no, she's decided who she's going to be. And who she's going to be is a goodie.
It's genuinely that ending line when she goes, hang on, I'll come with you. I can just see in my head that classic Star Wars circular, you know, like scene
yes.
fade to credits.
Yes, you're so right.
But perfect. And the music gets going and you're like, yeah. Timothy Zahn got Star Wars. He does a slightly more adult and maybe slightly more sci-fi-ish lean on Star Wars, on the Star Wars spectrum. But I don't think it's that necessarily that makes it good. He is a good writer that got what I think fundamentally works in the original. He puts his own spin on it. And what he does really well is he has the confidence and the skill to add to it in meaningful ways. He brings new characters in and gives them the space to be characters.
That's right. It's like a Star Wars RPG. You give a place for new heroes to emerge who feel convincing. That's what people loved about The Mandalorian, along with, you know, like the great relationship between Grogu and Mando. I know he has a real name. Jin?
Okay, I'm not even going to pretend I can remember this one. Yeah, Mando.
Mando. The great relation to those characters, but the fact that Ring It really works is the fact that, yeah, it's new characters. It's people who really feel like they belong in the Star Wars setting, who don't need a lot of connection to the real and the canon. Except when Luke Skywalker shows up at the end of season two, and I guess Boba Fett shows up. Again, but those are the bad bits. Those are the bits that don't work.
I like
it. Anytime Ahsoka Tano turns up, I'm like, go away, shoot, go back to the new guys. They're fun.
And I think it's really nice that although a lot of these characters sometimes have a little of that 2.0, like we say Card is a bit like Han Solo 2.0, I never feel like Card is there to replace Han Solo.
It's just
there to explore another element. While Han's having his new growth, Card is doing his own arc. Mary Jade isn't there to be the new Luke. She's there to be alongside Luke and to grow under Luke.
I'm going to say two more things. I'm only going to float this one because I'm not going to get a chance to talk about it in future episodes because we're not going to talk about Star Wars ever again. My girlfriend has said numerous times to me that they should make a new Star Wars TV show where Sebastian Stan plays middle-aged Luke Skywalker. So not post-Return of the Jedi CGI-faced Luke Skywalker and not present-day real-life Mark Hamill, the in-between bit, the adventures in between, he'll have him be played by Sebastian Stan. And my point to her was, but they're so committed to the idea that it's still Mark Hamill, that they're putting digital goo over the face of like a stuntman who plays the body of Luke Skywalker, who looks exactly like young Mark Hamill. And then I came up with a solution. I know how you could make middle-aged Luke Skywalker Star Wars TV show. Duncan, are you ready for my genius idea?
Did you say animated? I think I've got you, but...
No. That's the shortcut. That's the easy way. No. This is pure Zornian genius, Duncan.
Not cloning.
No, listen.
Go on.
Luke Skywalker, he returns to the planet Hoth. This is goo-faced CGI Luke Skywalker. He's roaming around. Then who should appear but a one-armed Wumpa, which then strikes him hard in the face. Now, as we know, in between episode 4 and episode 5, Mark Hamill was in a horrible car accident, which changed his face. So the first thing that happens in The Empire Strikes Back, he gets struck in the face. And there's a reason why he looks a little different now. So Luke gets smacked in the face by a one-on Wumpa again. He chops off that Wumpa's other arm. He gets put back in the back to tank. He gets out. Now he looks like Sebastian Stan. You do this for 4 seasons. Sebastian Stan plays. And then he goes back to Hoth. And he gets kicked in the face by the same Wumpa. He chops off his legs. And then he goes back into the back to tank. And he comes out as present-day Mark Hamill. There we go. Perfect canonicity. Beautiful. Genius.
I mean... if that's what it takes, I'm...
You cannot dispute this!
I would love to see these characters get recast. I'm very much of the mind that, you know, a character is not just the actor. I love James Bond. It never bothers me that the actor changes. I've never questioned it. You just understand. That's what happens.
I don't know. That feels different. Like, Doctor Who and James Bond, they have a different relationship.
Oh, no. Doctor Who's not in that camp. Doctor Who has a canonical reason why his face changes. That's its own thing, mate.
That is different, and I appreciate that, but he's still the same sort of character as James Bond, where the actor comes in and changes the character. I disagree. I think that characters like Luke and Han and Leia, that ability to change them up does not exist. I guess I have a different relationship to this because I haven't watched the animated TV shows like you have. You've seen reinterpretations of the same character by different actors. I just don't have that experience.
No, very fair. Geordie, you said you have one other thing you wanted to bring up.
I love the title of this book. And I love the way it's incorporated into the story. I didn't see it coming. I thought that the last command meant either it's the literal last command which, like, Thrawn's going to give before the final attack, before he's cut down and exploded. Or the last command could also mean something else. A command isn't just something you do, it's something you have. The last command of a ship, the final stand. That's what I really thought it meant. But no... what is the last command that a book's referring to? And it's called out very specifically in one scene, Duncan.
Oh, I'm really going to get this wrong. I've always thought it was kill Luke Skywalker.
It is. It's exactly right. That's what it is. And I didn't see that coming. I really should have, but no. That's what it's all about.
You're absolutely right. And to be fair, going into this book, I distinctly remember thinking it must refer to, like, Thrawn. Oh, he's the last command. He's the last guy in charge of the Empire. Take out Thrawn and you take down the Empire. That's what I originally thought before starting reading this.
I really should have seen it coming because my cover has Mara Jade glowering into the foreground and in the background is a massive face of Luke Skywalker all in red. And that's definitely a artistic depiction of the last command, kill Luke Skywalker. She's also...
See, I have a much older cover design. I think this might be the original cover. And it literally has... Thorne's not even on it. You've got Sir Boeth in, like, the front right-hand corner, just with his arms in the air. You've got Han and Leia just leaning on each other in the other corner. And then you have Luke and Mira crossing lightsabers in the centre.
A scene which does not happen.
No, and also...
she doesn't even fight Luke and cross swords with him. She just stabs him.
Yeah. I think they peaked early in the cover department. Heir to the Empire has an amazing one. But again, though, Sabaoth is in the front and centre as the villain. If you look at the covers, I don't think you think Thrawn was that important to these. Geordie.
Duncan, I'm ready to wrap there.
Okay, very well. I think that's good. So on to the last bit. Recommendations. Geordie, do you recommend this book? Of this trilogy?
I do indeed. I recommend all three books to fans of Star Wars. There is a reason why people were disappointed when The Force Awakens was due to come out and they were like, damn it, now these stories are never going to be adapted. And it is a pity, because this would make a great adaptation to the silver screen, and that's unlikely to ever happen. So read it, enjoy it. I beg this of you.
Obviously, I'm in the exact same boat. I made Geordie read these. He had such prejudice about the idea of Star Wars tie-in novels, movie tie-in books. They feel a bit dirty. They feel like not proper literature. If you like Star Wars, if you have enjoyed it, if you've ever felt like you have disliked some of the more modern stuff that's come out, if you've just watched the original trilogy and enjoyed that experience, read these books. Please, if reading books isn't good enough for you, the comic adaptation of these is fantastic. There are 6 issues per one of the books. All the dialogue is taken directly. Like, they are very loyal and absolutely fantastic. So give them a shot.
Well, Dunk, we're leaving behind a galaxy far, far away. It's time to return back to more familiar ground and read books that are undisputably fantasy. We've been pushing it this year. I think most people do acknowledge that Star Wars is fantasy. But we also read Dune this year, and I feel like people still will not have forgiven me for that. So I think it's time to get back into more familiar ground.
Will there be a wizard? Is this undisputable fantasy with pointy hats and medieval swords?
Okay, none of those things are in the next book I'm going to recommend. And it also just occurs to me that some people could argue that this is not fantasy either.
Geordie, what are you doing? You're destroying our brand, but yes, go on.
I'm not. I'm returning to our strengths. Because Duncan, every summer we read a Troy book. Somehow this has become a tradition.
Very unintentionally, but yes, it does.
And I hope for us to keep doing this. I mean, there are a fair few yet to come. So for at least the next, I don't know, 4 years... we can keep reading Troy books, and that's what I intend to do.
I'm racking my brain now.
I am going hiking, Duncan, and I need something to listen to whilst I'm on the trail, and I know where that's going to be. This is a long time coming. I've wanted to read it for a long time. I want us to read Kirky by Madeline Miller.
Circe by Madeline Miller.
By people. Also known as Circe by Madeline Miller by people who don't know ancient Greek, but her name is Kirky. They didn't have a s sound in ancient Greek. The c's are k's. That's why he's called Kronos.
Wow. I'm telling you now, I've already read this book.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I read it before.
I had no idea.
No, I read this book before I even read Song of Achilles.
You did not say that 2 years ago when we read Song of Achilles.
Gotta let in a couple of secrets.
Wow.
Not strictly speaking a Troy book, but very close.
It is a Troy book. It's related to Troy. I'm going to count it. Odysseus is an important aspect, I think. I haven't read it.
It's still a fantastic read, Geordie. I cannot wait to revisit this with you and for you to experience it for the first time.
Well, I'm super excited. And I hope to hear how excited you are. Please, you can tell us about whether Kirky is a Troy book or not. You can complain about my pronunciation all you like on our Instagram. Is this just fantasy podcast?
Also, the best place to go if you want to tell us how wrong we are about Star Wars and all the facts I got wrong over talking about this trilogy. Because I've looked back over some of the past episodes, Geordie, and God, I say a few things that I'm like, oh... hardcore fans will hate me for that one. But yes, best places on our Instagram, This Is Just Fantasy Podcast. You can also hit us up on our Gmail, thefantasypodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate and like this episode, if you did.
Absolutely. I've been putting in some serious effort into the Instagram recently, so I really do recommend it. Oh my god, there's a Munchjack just walking around outside my window. Come here, Mr. Munchjack. Would you like to hear about podcasts? I got distracted. Yes, come to our Instagram. I'm actually doing, extra reviews and shit there now. Like, I'm really taking it seriously.
And I'm letting the side down, so hopefully I'll get something out to you all. Maybe a detailed type-up of Nemesis Games.
Well, I've been your host, Jordy Bailey.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
This could conceivably be our last episode, Duncan. Like, I'm going on a pretty difficult hike. I might not come back.
Well, then, do you know what, Jordy? I'll be upset, but I think this is quite high. Last command meant a lot, and to share it with you, it's been a pleasure. Don't die.
Would you replace me with someone else, Duncan?
I've already got the man lined up.
Damn, wow, oh, brutal. Duncan, this is like when your girlfriend asks you if you'd love her if she was a worm. The answer is always... Wait, no, you're supposed to say yes. Oh, no, I need to call my girlfriend. I have to go. Bye.
Bye.